This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 17th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today security practitioner Eric Cole. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Eric is the CEO of Secure Anchor. And before he became a commercial practitioner, Eric spent several years at the CIA working in information security. He's written 7 books on computer security, including works on steganography and insider threats and basic network security. And he's an expert instructor with consistently high marks from his students. Eric holds a PhD from Pace University. So thanks for talking to us from your trip out to California.
No problem at all.
You've had a really interesting career path moving from the government, where you were working for the CIA, to corporate America, where you work for Telligent, among other companies, to kind of quasi-academic instruction, where you're doing lots and lots of commercial training now. And that made me wonder, how has your thinking evolved as you moved through these organizations?
That's a great question. What it really comes down to is I'm really focused on helping individuals and helping organizations solve difficult problems, because you know, with security, you look at attacks from 10 or 15 years ago, you look at attacks from today. In some cases, a lot of organizations still don't really understand what it takes to solve security problems. So when I was at the government, which I loved, and I had a great opportunity to do a lot of learning, I just kept seeing a lot of organizations out there just not get it right. So I said, okay, I need to go into the commercial world and help these organizations implement their security. But what I quickly realized is doing internal security at organizations, especially with startups, is as soon as they start having money trouble, you're an overhead function. And when you're an overhead function, your budget starts getting cut. So then I said, okay, the consulting is a good way to go. And consulting is great, and I love it, but you're sort of focused on one company at a time. So what I love with some of the instructions and the work I'm doing with SANS is I can now get 200 or 300 companies in a room at one time and really be able to help them find out what their problems are, solve them, and give them creative solutions.
So for you, it's always been about trying to get the point across to as many people as possible, sounds like.
Exactly. Those 3 letters after my name, PhD, means I like to do 2 things.
I thought that meant piled higher and deeper.
Well, that too.
That's what mine means.
you know, especially if you add the BS and MS person in there, right?
Right, exactly.
Those 3 letters mean I sort of like to research, find out new creative solutions, and teach individuals. So at least I've sort of been true to that portion of it.
So what do you think are some of the fundamental differences between, say, a government approach to security? And I suppose that was really among your first exposure to computer security as a discipline, as opposed to, say, screwing around on your Commodore 64, and corporate security.
Probably the big difference really comes down to regulation and budget. Because when you're with the government, budgets really don't matter as much. You sort of have a set budget, and it's not dictated by corporate profit, by other factors and other things. However, you do get a lot of regulations and other factors and politics that really come into play that influence it. On the commercial end, it's really all about showing value.
Right.
One of the big problems most individuals have when they do corporate security is they go off, they do their job, they secure the organization, and in a lot of cases, if you do security properly, what occurs?
Well, your budget gets cut because clearly nothing happened.
Bingo, nothing happened. So from an executive's perspective, you hit the nail on the head. They sit there after a year and say, well, nothing bad happened, therefore I'm wasting money on security, and their budget gets cut, when in reality they did a whole lot. So one of the things that I always say with corporate America, you have to do a much better job communicating to the executives. Put together simple charts. One of the ones I love is the number of blocked attacks. Everybody has firewalls. Everybody has a default deny rule set, and anything that hits that default deny rule set is hostile traffic.
A success, right, yeah.
So why not go in, count those up, plot a little graph, and every month just give those executives one chart, not 50, not 100 pages, one simple chart that says, did you realize we had 12,000 attempted attacks against our network that we successfully blocked, and now all of a sudden you're showing your net worth or value to that organization.
I also like making it personal with executives. So if you draw the analogy between security and term life insurance, you say, well, you know, you really only get payback when you die. Do you want to be dead?
That's a great way to look at it, because I always use that where security is all about risk to critical asset, which means it's exactly like the insurance industry.
Yeah.
Bad things happen to individuals, but the reason why insurance companies stay in business is because they take calculated risks and they know what value to place on different things. And organizations need to realize that sometimes bad things will happen. That doesn't mean security failed. It just means you've had to take calculated risks so your business can function.
Yeah. I like the metric that you suggested. I know that there's been a lot of work recently in the field trying to figure out what good security metrics might be. And we had some guys up at Metricon, for example, last week in Boston. And it's still a black art. It's hard to know exactly what you should measure and how you can demonstrate ROI effectively. I think we have a lot of room in the field to improve along those lines.
Exactly. And a lot of it, I think, sort of depends on the risk posture of the organization. If you're taking a university-type setting versus a hospital versus a pharmaceutical organization, while some high-level metrics are going to be the same, because the risk postures and the focus are completely different, one is so concerned on confidentiality, one is on availability, one is just on the free flow of information in the academia sense. So you really have to try to think, okay, what is the common threads? And that's where I found that firewall one is something that can relate to almost any industry and shows instant value.
Right, right. So you have a PhD, and you've also been deeply involved in commercial certification schemes, including the GIAC and the CISSP stuff. What's the difference in your mind between the academic approach and the certification model?
They're slowly merging together, but the big difference I see is the academic approach is more about teaching you the fundamentals that you need, sort of the core knowledge skills, not things that you would directly use day-to-day in an obvious sense, but things that you would fall back on. And a great example is, in an academic sense, you get a lot more into the fundamental theories of lattices and BIPA and Bell LePadula and all those different models, mm-hmm. where you're never probably going to go into a commercial organization and have to build a lattice. But that core understanding of how it's done, when you go in and set up access controls, you're immediately going to think, okay, this is critical data. What's the information flow and what occurs and what could be the leakage potential? So you inadvertently use that core knowledge on top of the current skill sets. As with certifications, are all about current practical skills that you could apply directly when you go to work. So a lot of these certifications will go in and talk about how you go in and design out a network, how you do a tier model, how you configure firewall with different rule sets. And while some of that does stay the same for a while, really how you configure it in terms of the threats that are out there, the different risks and vulnerabilities do change, because if you look at how we used to design networks 10 years ago and how we design networks today, while some of it's the same, today, because networks are so much more complex and porous and data so much more portable, we tend to do a lot more with tiered and separation and VLANs that we didn't do in the past. And that's, to me, one of the reasons why certifications have to keep getting renewed, because the technical day-to-day knowledge is always changing, but a degree lasts a lifetime because it's that core fundamental knowledge that really doesn't change for 20 or 30 years.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a good way of explaining it. What do you think, do people need to have that base set of knowledge in order to take the most advantage of their certification? I mean, do these things coexist, or in some cases, is it okay to just be certified and not have any degrees in any field whatsoever? What do you think about kind of our basic practitioners out there?
A lot really depends on the career path that you want to take, but my general view of it is really the certifications and the degrees are just proof to others. To really be a good practitioner, to me, the two things you really need in network security is to be creative, because in a lot of cases in the past, security was always the people who said no.
Right.
Can we do this? No, no, no.
Right.
Well, the short answer is this. If somebody comes to you and you keep telling them no, they're just not going to ask you anymore. So today, security is, to me, all about saying yes in a creative manner. So you really have to have that creativity juices in your flowing of coming up with really unique ways, and you really have to have that thirst for knowledge, because there's always new problems, always new issues. At a base level, the certification at least is a good way to show others, bosses, for promotion, for other jobs, other individuals, that, hey, I have this base knowledge, I understand this base knowledge. But we all know that there's some people out there that have certifications and a ton of degrees and don't really know what they're doing.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Sometimes a certification means you once had $500.
Exactly, that you were able to read a book for a while and regurgitate back some information. So while I do think certifications have value, to me the focus needs to be on the knowledge aspect, and then the certification is a proof of the knowledge, as opposed to the way some people get it, where the certification drives everything and knowledge is secondary. And then when you get to the degrees, a lot of people ask me sort of with a PhD, and what I tell people is, I think a PhD is great, but it's so much work and so much discipline that if it's not a personal goal of yours, you're probably not going to get through it.
Yeah, and it shows that you're determined enough to get through the program.
Exactly, because typically with a PhD, there's so many ABDs out there, all but dissertation, that most advisors know once you finish the coursework, the chances of you actually finishing your dissertation is low, so they don't really give you the time of day. I sort of joke, they throw you out in the woods, and if you can actually make it and survive in the woods and make it to civilization, after 2 years and you have a couple published articles, then they say, oh, wow, this person is going to make it through. They latch it to you, and they help you through. But
So what was your thesis about? You're a hard guy to dig up information about out there, you know. You've hidden yourself very well in plain sight, as one of your books might suggest. But what was your thesis about?
Yeah, when you work for the CIA for 10 years, I guess you learn to hide pretty good, which a lot of people tell me in this industry. Some of it probably hurts me because I've done a lot, but I don't sort of publicize and have as much out there as some other individuals.
Right,
so
right.
Sometimes plays against me. But my thesis was actually on stego marking to protect data leakage in the insider threat environment.
Oh,
that's
cool.
Actually the human version of it. I can give you the more technical one later. So.
Oh, very cool.
What I did real quickly was, to me, the whole problem with information leakage and data flow is everyone tries to go in and protect the end host or protect the data as it's flowing across the network. And my whole philosophy is you got to protect the data when it's created. At its creation point, if you don't provide protection at that very moment, then there's always going to be ways to bypass it. So I took two fields, digital watermarking, which is applying a watermark that can't be removed,
mm-hmm.
and steganography, applying something that can't be seen. And stegomarking is putting a special mark on the data, so this way it can't be removed, it can't be seen. And the analogy I like to give is if I have a tank of gasoline and I have all the hazardous material on this tank, but I drop this tank in a box and I put a FedEx label on it, the FedEx people have no way of knowing there's hazardous material inside the box. So what stegomarking does is it bubbles up, so now wherever you put that hazardous material, the most outer container would always be marked.
Mm.
And the idea behind it is everyone's always about replacing existing security components. Let's get rid of firewalls and put in IPSs. Let's get rid of this and put in that. And to me, because security is about defense in depth and a layered approach, what stego marking does is let your firewalls and IDSs be more effective, because one of the problems of why firewalls and IDSs can't control data leakage is the firewall has nothing to block and the IDS has nothing to track. Mm-hmm. With Stego marking, now all of a sudden your firewall has something to block, your IDS has something to track, and you're actually taking your existing components and making them more effective in protecting your critical assets.
So I should have known better than to ask you about your thesis.
Exactly. You should have known that one was going to get me going. Come on.
So let's get back to pedagogy stuff. You've probably taught thousands of people in your various courses over the years. What do you think about your students? Are they getting better over the last few years? Have we sort of moved past the box checking with newbies model? And you know, who are the people that you train?
We're absolutely sort of getting better at what we're doing, and that's one of the things where we're always going in and updating the courses. And
no, I'm not talking about you being better. I'm talking about the people that are taking the courses that are coming in kind of off the street.
Exactly. Yeah, they're getting better and better. The big problem that we're seeing today is they don't know what the right thing to do is. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of these people and students that come into class, and they're sitting there, they're working 70, 80 hours a day, they're putting in all this energy, and a lot of them are starting to get to the point where they're frustrated because they almost feel like, hey, Eric, this security problem is insurmountable. I'm just putting more hours and I'm not getting anywhere. And it goes back to the whole thing, work smarter, not mm-hmm. harder. Mm-hmm. So what I'm finding is a lot of people want to do the right thing. However, they don't know what that is, so their frustration level is increasing. But when we go in and say, okay, let's talk about risk, let's cover the key critical things, and I give them sort of five things to go back to work and focus on initially in the next month, all of a sudden you see the smile come on their face and the light goes on, because now they're willing to put in the time, and now they realize they're putting their time against things that will actually make a difference.
Right,
and
so a risk-based approach really gives you a framework from which to approach the problem.
Exactly. So I think we're finally at the point now where individuals really want to do the right thing and they're getting frustrated, which is good, because when you get frustrating, that's when you look for a new way of solving the problem. And when we're giving them practical solutions, they're actually going back to work, making a difference, and then going to the next step.
So what kind of pedagogy techniques work best for you? I mean, you're such a popular instructor. Clearly, whatever you're doing is working. And if somebody wanted to be equally good at teaching people security, what's the technique that works best for you?
What I always tell individuals is, if you want to be a good instructor, you have to either be knowledgeable or you have to entertain. If you want to be a great instructor, you have to do both, because the ingredients is, if you can't keep somebody's attention, then I don't care how great an instructor you are, they're not going to be able to learn and they're not going to be able to absorb the knowledge. So you have to be able to keep their attention span going. The other thing that I'm a big fan of is analogies. Mm-hmm. Because when you're going into a new area, if you start talking about bits and bytes and crypto and all that other stuff, people can very quickly get confused and not realize what's going on. But if you use an analogy, it works very well. And a quick example is IDS. Mm-hmm. You've of course heard Gartner's article that IDS is dead, and my whole philosophy is IDS is not dead, your implementation of it is, because people don't realize an IDS doesn't do any good if you're not watching the alerts and reacting. So a quick analogy is, an IDS is an alarm system at your house. If you have an alarm system at your house, but you don't hire a company to monitor that alarm system,
what's the point?
Exactly, and you're away on vacation and somebody breaks in and the alarm goes off and nobody notices it for 4 days, it does absolutely no good.
I think they're more like car alarms, actually. They're just going off all the time and really no one cares. It's just
exactly.
Sort of annoying noisemakers.
Which is another great analogy.
So one of the challenges in security is this complete lack of knowledge among some people, to the point that even basic ideas come as a great surprise, all the way to the huge amounts of knowledge and experience required to be a real expert. And so that sort of calls into question how much knowledge an average practitioner needs, know, is where does it fall on that spectrum from, you know, very, very basic security know-how all the way to deep knowledge and experience?
That's a hard one because everybody sort of learns at different rates. So I know a lot of organizations use years that say, okay, a junior is one and three. But to me, that doesn't work because some people can learn at different levels.
Right.
What it comes down to, and a lot of people miss, is to me, security is starting to get to the point where it's ingrained in everything that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody says, Eric, I want to be an expert in security, where do I start? I say pick a foundational area. So you got to first go in, if you're going to do network security, firewalls and IDSs, you better understand networking, TCP/IP, and be able to analyze packets. If you want to go in and do architectural or host-based security, then you better know Windows or BSD or Linux inside and out.
Uh-huh.
So I think the area that's missed is people forget to get the core knowledge area that they need to support that other knowledge. So I would usually say that you have to probably have pretty good knowledge in either the networking and OS or one of those core areas, and then understand what the exposure points are. Because in a lot of cases, and I'm going to oversimplify, but it really fits this way. If somebody's going to break in to your network from the outside, it's real simple. First, they have to see your system. So systems that don't need to be visible, take them off the network.
Right. Yeah.
Then they have to find a port. Then once they connect to that port, they have to find a vulnerability on a service. So really, if you're talking about hardening and protecting from attacks from the outside, it really comes down to reduce visibility, turn off ports, and harden your services. And then if we're talking about the insider threat, it's all about access control. But a great example there is so many companies are focused on access control, least privilege, that they say all the acronyms, but if you don't have some sort of data classification in place, then how in the world are you going to give somebody the least amount of access they need to do their job?
I'm totally with you. I mean, the whole notion of not having a policy to enforce. You know, when it comes to data security, my opinion is that the technology is far outstripping the policy that we're trying to enforce with technology right now.
Exactly. Everybody loves the latest and greatest technology and the gizmo, but they forget that a gizmo doesn't do any good if you don't have the foundational pieces in place.
So I would be remiss in my duties as a host if I didn't ask you at least one question about software security. And you probably know I'm really excited that software security is finally catching on, and so much so that demand for developers who have a clue about software security is way, way up. And so I think that that's good for many things, and it's also kind of bad in some senses because there's a lot of pressure to fudge things. And I'm worried, for example, about these certification schemes based on testing people's ability to find bugs or just find problems. And so I'm worried about degenerating into what I've called the bug parade approach to software security, and wondered if you have any thoughts about that. Is there an analogy from the network security space of 10 or 15 years ago when that was really just beginning to catch on that we can use to negotiate these tricky waters?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's really one of my pet peeves that I push really, really hard is you look at typical conferences or other locations and hacking courses sell out, but nobody will go to a secure coding class.
Oh, absolutely. I call this the NASCAR effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm sitting there going, well, wait a second. I mean, we wouldn't have to worry about hacking if the code was built securely in the first place. So I'm definitely glad we're at that point. But yeah, what we're at with a lot today is organizations want immediate results. So what happens is as we start getting into the secure coding paradigm, instead of focusing on building a good, solid design, what's happening now is they're focused on, okay, what are our big exposure points?
Yeah, well, and they're focused mostly on bugs. Here's a buffer overflow, there's a cross-site scripting error, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And a lot of that I would go back is if you go back to sort of the 1920s, 1930s in building codes. back then, they used to have a lot of problems and issues with buildings and other things falling down and not being secure. And the first approach was sort of the bug approach. Well, let's go in and let's have inspectors find all these bugs and problems with the house before people occupy it, so this way they can be fixed. Mm-hmm. But what builders quickly realized is that's very, very expensive.
Because yeah, I had to rebuild that room 10 times.
Exactly. And the same thing is happening on security, where doing the bug approach is a very, very expensive proposition. Now, the good news is your code's not making it out to the public where it's doing harm, but you're going to have to rewrite this stuff over and over again. So to me, what it really comes down to is the discipline of writing code, making sure the programmers go in and follow those key areas, make sure they're doing the right things in terms of the error checking, how the data flow goes, and others. And the analogy I like to give is, if you look at the patent and trademark exam, if you want to be a patent attorney, one of the things they actually have you do on the exam is write a patent. Because you can go in and analyze a patent and find holes or problems with it, but that doesn't mean that you can write it correctly.
Right.
So I think with a lot of the secure software, the best way to really go in and do that is, just like the patent exam, have somebody write a piece of code.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, one of the big problems in development is this. You can't tell a good developer from a bad one unless you make them write code. And so I'm not really aware of any sort of testing paradigm or even degree-granting paradigm that can separate a good coder from a bad coder. And starting from there, it's really difficult to say how to build security on top, but it's certainly a challenge we're going to have to address. On the other hand, I think what you said that is most important of all is this notion of getting up over the level of code and thinking about higher level things like Salzer and Schroeder's famous security principles. And I know that you've used a lot of that in your writing and your thinking. And so I wondered if you had any favorite principle. And if you do, how do you teach people about it, since it's sort of a philosophy thing?
Yeah, the four that I tell, whenever I teach, whenever I do anything, I always leave my students with four thoughts, which is, know thy system.
Yep.
If you don't know a system, how can you secure it? Defense in depth, have
yep.
multiple levels of protection.
Yep.
Access control, give somebody the least amount of access they need. And
so
prevention
principle
is
of least privilege.
Yeah, least privilege. And prevention is ideal, but detection is a must.
Right.
Try to prevent attacks, but realize some will sneak in, and you must be able to detect them on the back end.
Oh, that's very good. So see, we got to get those points across to the software guys, too, which is a more difficult proposition, frankly.
Exactly.
So, what do you do for fun outside of computer security?
Do computer security. it's funny. I tell everyone I have three huge passions in life: my family and kids, computer security, and intellectual property. So I guess the real question is, when I'm not playing with my kids and doing security, I'm usually writing patents or coming up new ways to protect intellectual property.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem. I appreciate the interview.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.